Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just how dysfunctional are things on Capitol Hill? It's not just that lawmakers can't come to terms on funding the government past the end of next week. They can't even agree on the consequences of their inaction. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid fears a government shutdown. Republican House Speaker John Boehner insists there's no threat of government shutdown. What we have here is a failure to communicate. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Go ahead and breathe. We made it to Friday, the 23rd of September. Glad you're with us. We've said it before, and we'll probably end up saying it again. If Congress can't agree on a bill to fund operations through mid-November, the government could shut down next week. It continues to look like we're approaching that precipice for the third time in a year. This time, the bickering is over roughly $7 billion for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, covering relief costs from Hurricane Irene and other disasters. The House wants $7 billion worth of corresponding cuts. Today, the Senate said, no way. Compared to the trillions overall to keep the government going, this is pocket change. But as Marketplace's David Gura reports, the implications are much bigger.
Ross Baker can hardly believe Congress is fighting over disaster relief. He used to be a staffer on Capitol Hill. Now he's a political science professor at Rutgers.
This is the kind of issue that 20 years ago would not have led to a possible government shutdown.
That's because in the grand scheme of things, this probably isn't a fight worth having.
The absolute amount of money that we're talking about is insignificant, a virtual rounding error.
That's Stan Collender. He's a budget expert with Corvus. The federal budget for 2010 was almost $3.5 trillion. Collender says this isn't about the money. It's about House Republicans standing on principle. They've vowed to make cuts to cover any spending. And with our economy in such bad shape, he says that's a risky position.
Look, there's nothing good about a shutdown.
But Collender says we may see this kind of brinksmanship again and again. Donald Marin used to head the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. He says the business of governance has changed.
Deadlines and precipices are what drives action.
Politicians no longer focus on long-term solutions. And that worries another former CBO director, Alice Rivlin.
If we can't get even a small thing done, we send a message to the public, to business, to the markets, that we haven't got a competent government in charge that can even solve small problems.
But we've got one that seems to be getting better and better at creating them. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
If you're struggling to pay the bills, this idea might sound familiar. It pays to take on a roommate. Sears has offered to take on roommates, typically other stores, at almost all of its locations across the country. Now it's announced two new deals. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports on the economics of the subletting.
Sears is what's known in the retail business as overstored. Too much space, too few sales.
People just aren't going to the stores in the way that they used to.
Analyst Matt McGinley of ISI Group says Sears stores bring in $1.28 a square foot in profit a year. For Macy's, that figure is closer to $15. For AutoZone, it's $55. McGinley says Sears
could rent that space to a retailer that can ultimately give them higher profitability in that space than what Sears can get.
In California, Sears is giving up a chunk of its space to an athletic club, a grocery store, a Forever 21. Faith Hope Consolo is with Prudential Douglas Elliman Real Estate.
Will it help them in sales of their other products? I could see how this synergy could be interesting.
Best Buy and JCPenney have also announced subleasing deals. Marianne Bickel of the Center for Retailing at the University of South Carolina says stores have gotten more efficient about stocking merchandise.
So retailers are getting really smart on how to really have a smaller footprint.
Sears, which also owns Kmart, has around 4,000 spaces available. Analyst Matt McGinley says some are more desirable than others.
They have sites in locations like Flint, Michigan, where there's very little chance of them being able to have a retailer come in.
McGinley says the only solution for Sears may be the ultimate downsizing, closing stores. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Only about a week before pro basketball players were supposed to start reporting to training camps for the new season ahead, there's been a shift in plans that's bound to leave fans disappointed. Today, the NBA postponed the training camps and canceled preseason games. Players and team owners remain divided over how to divvy up the profits. And now, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, both sides are anxiously calculating how much they can afford to lose.
When negotiations stalled yesterday, NBA team owners took a look into the abyss but did not blink. Kenneth Shropshire is director of the Wharton Sports Business Initiative. He says that by canceling the preseason games, the owners are sending a message.
It's certainly a strategic move in terms of this is how serious we are. And, you know, we have put the season by the wayside in the past back in 98, and we can do it again this year if we need to.
The standoff is all about money. Players currently get 57% of revenues. Team owners want to cut that to around 50%. Under any deal, in percentage terms, players will make less. But University of Chicago economist Alan Sanderson says it's not because all NBA owners are greedy.
In the NBA, it's entirely possible for an individual franchise to lose money, and some are.
According to Forbes, last year, more than half the teams lost money. Eventually, Sanderson expects teams in smaller markets, like Memphis or New Orleans, could be transferred or simply disappear.
It wouldn't surprise me to see the NBA, which has 30 teams now, move down to 28, for example.
Some teams are flush, others are broke. Kenneth Shropshire says the owners of teams in small markets would like big market owners to share more revenues.
Until that happens, a lot of the push comes to get some of those dollars back from the players.
If a deal isn't reached by mid-October, the NBA season will be cut short or canceled. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
It wasn't a big bounce for stocks, but hey, we'll take what we can get. Details when we do the numbers. This week, things veered back to ugly. Markets tanked, and the global economy appears weaker than ever. So let's turn to a couple of the cheeriest folks I know to discuss all this cheery stuff. Time for the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond. Joining us are Sadeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal and Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, geez, Sadeep, how are you feeling at the end of this week?
Well, with everything going on, it seems like the only thing that could make things worse is a giant meteor coming toward the Earth to really make us a little more unsettled.
Or a falling satellite, maybe, huh?
Exactly. It just things don't look very good right now.
We did talk to John Lipsky, a special advisor to the IMF this week, and he said that he isn't worried about a global recession as long as certain measures are taken by world economies to, quote, rebalance, unquote. What risks do you see, Lee?
Well, I mean, this week there's a lot of gloom hanging over the situation in Europe, and that is fueling this talk of a global, another global recession, something on a global scale. But, you know, I think it's important to remember that the situation here in the U.S. is very different from Europe, and if things were cranking right here right now, I don't think we would really even be concerned with Europe. I don't want to oversimplify things, but the market's so psychological, and a lot of what we're feeling today, especially after yesterday, was the reaction to the Fed's movement here. And so that's fueling a lot of the concern here in the U.S. The situation in Europe is definitely grave, and it's getting graver because there does seem to be a lot of talk and little action.
Sadeep, you've been following all the news out of the G20 meetings, the IMF and World Bank. What might come out of these meetings that might help things?
Well, unfortunately, what people have been looking for, which is new action, just isn't happening. The G20 issued a statement trying to calm markets and reassure people, but it was certainly a clear recognition from governments that they recognize they're in a race against markets right now, and they recognize they need to take action. The problem is that on a global scale, we're seeing political paralysis. It's just a total breakdown in some cases, basic government functioning. The government in Slovenia this week broke down, and if anyone can wonder about the world we're living in, Slovenia is one country that needs to pass the Eurozone measure to expand their bailout fund, and when the Slovenian government breaks down and that starts hurting markets in the U.S., you know we're in trouble.
Which brings us stateside now. Lee, we're headed toward another government shutdown, as mentioned. It occurs to me that while politicians wrestle over what amounts to not that much money, this is a pretty dramatic indicator that jobless Americans are going to be kept waiting for action. And the president's observation that they can't afford to wait till Election Day in 14 months is falling on deaf ears. What do you make of this?
It's true. I mean, we're seeing the exact same kind of impasse we saw over the summer and then back in the spring. And, you know, we are facing such a fundamental divide between the way, A, this country should be run, and B, how we should get out of this crisis, that nothing is going to happen. And we're proving that if we can't get little things done, like funding the government for the next 7 days or 7 weeks, how are we going to get fundamental big things done? And if we don't get anything done, we're not going to get our jobs back, and we're not going to get our economy back.
Okay, Sudeep, I was going to say you're close to the action, but you're close to the inaction in D.C. Your sense that an agreement will be reached, and how?
There probably will be an agreement, because there usually is an agreement at the last minute. But just like with the debt ceiling showdown, a lot of damage is being done right now. If you're a business owner, you have to look at this problem and say, why should I risk my capital? Why should I add jobs? And the frightening lesson of the 2008-2009 recession is that markets can turn quickly and the economy can turn quickly and turn down fiercely. And so why stomach the risk? Why put yourself in that position when you don't have a chance to protect yourself? And that's what a lot of people are seeing right now when they see this government in action.
Hmm. Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, we thank you once again for being with us.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
Given the threat to the NBA season we mentioned earlier, you might want to enjoy this while you can. We've still got the final few days of baseball's regular season. Several teams are on the playoff bubble, and they need to win or they won't make the postseason. Today, the movie Moneyball opens in theaters. It's the story about a team that changed the business of baseball a few years back. That would be the Oakland Athletics. And as commentator John Wertheim points out, their cleat prints are all over what we'll see this weekend.
Statistical modeling, algorithms, and 20-somethings tooling around on their laptops. It doesn't sound like the elements that can be alchemized into cinematic gold. But who knows? Social Network was among the best films of last year. And now here comes the sports version, Moneyball. It tells the story of the turn of the 21st century Oakland A's and hard-charging general manager Billy Beane, played by Brad Pitt. Note the past tense here. Today, the A's are still constrained by a small payroll and a tight budget. They're a team devoid of stars with a record well south of the 500 mark, and they're about to miss the playoffs for the fifth straight season. As such, without giving away too much, Moneyball doesn't end with a dramatic and triumphant World Series victory for the underdogs. But the story does feature a classic business-style ending. The Moneyball strategy entailed applying new metrics to discover undervalued talent, to find those unmined gems. The tactic, if that's what you want to call it, enabled the A's to hold their own against teams with more cavernous pockets, such as the Yankees and the Red Sox. For 5 of 7 seasons, around the time Michael Lewis reported and wrote his excellent book on which the movie's based, the A's made the playoffs. In business terms, the A's front office found an inefficiency in the market and took advantage of an opportunity. But much the same way nature abhors a vacuum, markets dislike inefficiencies. Soon enough, the other firms, or teams, used similar Moneyball techniques, and Oakland's competitive advantage eroded. The Red Sox, for instance, hired Seminole baseball statistician Bill James, and not coincidentally, ended the franchise World Series curse in 2004. Baseball front offices have become the provinces of newly minted MBAs and Wall Street refugees, using metrics and strategies once used to find value in securities to find value in switch-hitting shortstops. Today, every team in major sports has an analytics department. Today, everyone is playing Moneyball.
John Wertheim is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. It's your ball now. Send us your comments at marketplace.org. Just click on the contact link. Coming up, Germany does a double take over the cost of the Eurozone bailouts.
80% of the German public are fed up with helping Greece, Portugal, and in the future, probably Spain, Italy, and finally even France.
But first, let's do the numbers. Finally, a bounce back after a choppy day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 37 points, or 1/3%, to close at 10,771. The NASDAQ added 27 points, 1 1/10% to finish at 2483. The S&P 500 inched up 6 points, 0.6% to end the day at 1136. For the week, which was dominated by recession fears, the Dow gave back 6.4%. That's the biggest weekly percentage loss for the big board since, you got it, October 2008. The NASDAQ fell 5.3%. The S&P 500 was the biggest loser, shedding 6.6%. Financial stocks rebounded today. Morgan Stanley led the pack once again, this time with a gain. Shares of the investment bank rang up 5%. Bank of America and Citigroup each added more than 4%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of August. The first North American Consumer Product Safety Summit gets underway in Bethesda, Maryland. And it's the anniversary of another first, the first televised presidential debate. It took place on September 26, 1960, with candidates John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Perhaps you've heard of Facebook. The social network's 800 million users are in for a sweeping redesign of their personal web pages. The changes were unveiled at Facebook's annual developers conference in San Francisco yesterday and will roll out to members in the coming weeks. A new profile page called Timeline will archive everything you ever share on Facebook forever. And expect more additions you didn't know you needed. Our own Steve Henn got a sneak peek and joins us now. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
So is this going to make this online powerhouse even more powerful? What do you think?
Well, you know, I think it could. From a design perspective, the reviews of Facebook's new feature Timeline have been pretty positive. Timeline reimagines how a Facebook profile works, and it makes it possible to scan through years of your life in sort of a visually beautiful way. It stores and archives all your posts and photos, and then tries to automatically highlight things that were important to you.
Now, this is just one part of what Facebook was up to, though, right?
That's right. It also unveiled a series of new apps to allow you to surf digital media and share what you're doing online almost automatically. So from what movies you're watching and what music you're listening to, even things like what you're cooking, Facebook wants to capture all of that and make it incredibly simple to post it and share it.
Okay, maybe I'm a geezer because when it comes to what my friends are watching on Hulu, frankly, my dear, and you know the rest.
Yeah.
But I know it's aimed at the age group that's the big prize. I take it younger online users just eat this stuff up.
Well, sure. Younger online users are more willing to share stuff than, you know, maybe you or I are. But Facebook was also pretty sensitive to try to design something that wasn't going to annoy your friends. So all of those kinds of automatic posts will fly by in this new ticker that is on the Facebook page on the right. And they'll be archived on your timeline. But what Facebook's really trying to do here is build a better kind of recommendation engine. So if you and a couple of my other friends all like Mad Men, it might actually pull that out and highlight it for me. Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, spoke at the event yesterday, and he said when Mark Zuckerberg first approached him about these ideas, he was skeptical. So he asked him,
well, what is success for you in this interaction, Mark? And he said, well, how big do you think you're going to grow next year? And I said, X. And he said, success for Facebook is if Netflix grows to 2X.
So what Zuckerberg thinks, and now what Hastings, I think, believes, is that by integrating digital media like Netflix or Hulu into this shared Facebook experience, it's going to change how the internet works and transform how millions of people buy things and discover things online.
Okay, let it be known I had oatmeal this morning and I'm watching Rango tonight. Sounds like the marketers still don't have enough personal data. Now they want every mundane detail about our lives?
Yep, that's pretty much it.
So how big is the impact going to be on media businesses?
Well, you know, I think it could be enormous. You remember Netflix announced earlier this week that it was splitting itself in two. And I'm actually convinced that decision has a lot to do with what Facebook is doing right now.
Whoa, we're almost out of time. You throw me that intriguing tidbit. So explain this to me, Quickster. Why would wanting a Facebook presence cause this big split for Netflix?
Well, because Netflix rents DVDs. And in the U.S., it's prevented from sharing customer information online this way by a 23-year-old law called the Video Privacy Protection Act. After Netflix spins off Quickster and is just offering streaming content like Hulu, I think it'll be much more likely to be legally free to jump in and create a Facebook app in the States.
Much easier to divulge what we stream than what we physically rent, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I wrote a post about it. It's online.
Marketplace's Steve Henn, thanks.
Sure thing.
This weekend, finance ministers from across the globe are gathering in Washington, D.C., and the Obama administration has wasted no time keeping pressure on Germany and France to act decisively on Europe's debt crisis before the woes of Greece, Italy, Spain, and others become America's problem. Already, Germany's Angela Merkel has pledged $200 billion in loan guarantees to ailing Eurozone partners. But there are signs of bailout fatigue in Germany, the country that's been doing much of the bailing. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from Berlin.
Florian Hessler sells food here on Alexanderplatz. Like all street vendors in Germany, he must be licensed. He pays his taxes, and he's appalled by the growing disorder in the Eurozone and that Germany has to pick up much of the tab for it.
Why should we always give our tax money to other countries? If they run up debts, they should pay them themselves.
Florian will be gritting his teeth next week when there's a special session of the German parliament. Angela Merkel's government will try to pass another multi-billion euro loan package for Greece. Matthias Warnecker campaigns on behalf of German taxpayers. He's not impressed.
It means using the old recipe, raising new debt to fight old debt. And that might buy us some time, but that won't solve the problems.
Some say Mrs. Merkel is part of the problem for failing to take definitive action. Moritz Schulerich is a professor of economic history.
It's part of her personality to be cautious, to avoid grand schemes, grand solutions, avoid being bold. She's sort of a one-step-at-a-time person.
Another German economist says a grand, bold move is exactly what's needed because this is a crisis of confidence. Ferdinand Fischner is with the DIW think tank. He says hedge funds have exploited Europe's disarray to bet against European government bonds. The Eurozone must fight back with overwhelming firepower.
Increasing the bailout fund would be an important signal that it simply doesn't make sense to speculate against euro area countries. If the rescue fund is big enough, it's quite clear that it's just not worth it.
How big does it have to be, though?
Maybe five times as big as it is right now.
That would be the equivalent of $3 trillion, with Germany stumping up a third of it. Henrik Enderlein of the Hertie School of Governance says this won't be easy. Germany just can't trust some of its European partners.
Greece lied on its fiscal and budgetary position in order to get into the euro area. So there is concern in Germany of people saying they've cheated once, they will cheat again.
The fear is that under the shelter of Germany's economic might, the Greeks and other less prudent Eurozone members will embark on another spending spree, and that will drag down Germany's credit rating. Hans-Olaf Henkel is a former head of Germany's main business organization. He wants an immediate end to all the bailouts for the sake of German democracy.
80% of the German public are fed up with those policies of continuing helping Greece, Portugal, and in the future probably Spain, Italy, and finally even France.
The message at this rally in Berlin could not have been clearer. We are against the euro. The euro is a threat to Europe. But that was the man with the megaphone. The response from the audience was telling. There were only about a dozen protesters there. The Germans are torn. They hate the bailouts, but they still cling to the euro for fear of what might happen if it were to collapse. In Berlin, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Next week, Stephen looks at how Germany has thrived under the euro and what would be lost if the currency implodes.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note, after Ben Bernanke and company took fresh aim this week at that menacing beast called the economy, one financial expert told us the Fed's arsenal is running out. And that reminded us how some commentators have long held out hope that the Fed might pull out some kind of magical ammunition.
We're talking about silver bullets.
More like a silver bullet.
That's the silver bullet.
There's no silver bullet.
Indeed. No silver bullet.
So many folks have used that term on past programs, we started wondering what it really means. No, Kimo Sabe, it did not originate with the Lone Ranger leaving silver bullets behind, but apparently in the superstition that it's the only way to kill werewolves or other supernatural beings.
The traditional story with which I most identify the silver bullet motif is a long, insane fairy tale by the Brothers Grimm called The Two Brothers. It's a story about the evils of greed and the goodness of brotherly love. Near the end of The Two Brothers, one of the heroes uses three silver buttons as bullets in his gun to bring a witch out of a tree.
How perfect! They're effective against the evils of greed. So says Kate Bernheimer, who teaches at the University of Louisiana in Lafayette and is the author of a collection of fairy tales. As legend has it, though, we're already too late.
There's often only one chance and one silver bullet. I'm afraid there are no more silver bullets for President Obama or the Federal Reserve to employ now.
Ah, so much for happy endings. But happy Friday. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 37 points, or 1/3%. The NASDAQ added 27 points, 1 1/10%. The S&P 500 inched up 6 points, 6/10%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, credit scores can befuddle and enrage most anyone. I mean, how do they come up with that number, and how do we make sense of it?
I'm in the best financial position I've been in my whole life now, and I have, like, the lowest credit score.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.